The following podcast is an exclusive presentation of Project Entertainment Network.
Project Entertainment Network presents My Favorite Story, an anthology featuring short fiction written by the hosts of the Project Entertainment Network podcasts, with
Mary San Giovanni and Brian Keane from The Horror Show,
Chuck Buddha, Aaron Sweet, El Mahari, and Armand Rosamilia of The Mando Method,
Jamie Engel of Origins,
Bizung's Mr. Frank,
Tom Clark from Necrocast, Ick On,
It Cooks, Amber Fallon,
Three Guys with Beards, Christopher Gold, Jim Moore, and Jonathan Mabry,
The Buttercup of Doom, Kelly O.
Matters of Faith's J. Wilburn,
John Urbansic of Eight Stains.
My Favorite Story, a podcast author anthology from Project Entertainment Network, available on Kindle, Nook, and soon in paperback from the Project Entertainment Network store.
Hey, everybody, and welcome to Monster Attack, the podcast dedicated to old monster movies. All right, we got an interesting one for you today. This is one that, I haven't had a chance to do. Too many films that really, really got panned over their lifetime, but this film has really caught it from a lot of critics and from a lot of people who watch monster movies. It comes to us from 1954. And it's one of the very first American films to deal with the subject of the abominable snowman, or Yeti. In fact, this is probably the first time that American audiences would hear the expression Yeti for the creature that lives in the Himalayan mountains. And it's called the snow creature, appropriately enough. Now, this film, a lot of you out there probably saying, oh yeah, I know this film. This film didn't get a whole lot of airplay on my monster movie matinee show that I talk about, the one that I grew up with, but it did get a few airings, but not many. It was not a real popular movie, and it has been the brunt of many, many jokes, and I think probably a lot of people remember this film more so for the ribbing it took at the hands of John Zacherle in his documentary Horrible Horror than anything else. That was one of the one documentary that I played over and over and over again, where he showed clips from the films that he showed on his monster show. One that I wasn't able to see much because it was pretty much a West Coast oriented show out of L.A. But he was still very, very well known around the country, did a lot of TV appearances and that sort of thing. And he had a lot of fun with this movie. So let's get right to it and talk about the snow creature. I will say right in the beginning here that it's not a great movie, and I'm not sure if I can recommend it to you, only except as maybe out of curiosity, what's everyone talking about? Because chances are, if you talk about folks who grew up during this time period or grew up in the 60s, they're going to know about the snow creature. Now, there was a film that came out a few years later from Hammer Films called the Abominable Snowman. Now, that's the one that everybody remembers very, very well. And, of course, it stars Peter Cushing. And we're going to talk about that film in a future show down the road here. We'll give it a few weeks, and then we'll come back and maybe make some comparisons, because there are some similarities between those two movies. It might be pushing it a little bit, but I see some similarities in the storylines between the two. I mean, you're dealing basically with expeditions going up into the Himalayas trying to seek this creature. Now, there's going to be some folks that say, hey, I think there was another film that came out before this one that dealt with the Abominable Snowman. And you would be correct, but it's one that didn't get much airplay in the United States, if any at all, in the 60s. And I can't even pronounce the title, but it was a Finnish movie that came out 4 months prior to the snow creature, and it dealt with these two adventurers. It was a popular TV show in Finland, and it dealt with these two guys that went on these various adventures. And it was the third film in their series of adventures, and they were out after the snow creature themselves. So I don't really count that. I count that, I guess, on a global sense. But as far as it comes to American audiences, this is the one that started it all off. And since then, you know, we've had quite a few films about the Yeti. And I will also include Sasquatch and Bigfoot with that, because essentially you're dealing with the same creature. He's just not, you know, living up in the snow-covered mountains of the Himalayas. Now, the director for tonight's film is a fellow by the name of W. Lee Wilder. And it may ring a few bells when you hear that name, because not so much for him, but for his famous brother. And unfortunately, people have been very, very brutal when it comes to old W. Lee, because they call him the talentless brother, because his brother was Billy Wilder, who was one of the most popular film directors and considered just an absolute genius director in comedies and that sort of thing. And people wrote for many years after Snow Creature came out, and one other film that W. Lee did called Killers from Space, which actually we're going to be talking about not too long from now, a Peter Graves tour de force back in his early days. Yeah, another film that's probably going to get a similar treatment from me. W. Lee just, he's an interesting fellow. And again, I want to say, I'm not going to really pan this movie. It's got some problems, but it's got some very specific problems. And it's a shame because, and this may show the, you know, the difference between W. Lee Wilder and his brother Billy Wilder, because just a couple of little things could have made this film much, much better. And it still has a fan base. There are people out there that actually enjoy this movie. And, you know, they'd say, you know, write reviews such as, you know, it's not bad. It's not all that bad. And it really isn't. I think it's gotten a little bit of a bad, bad shake because people have really jumped on top of some of the other critics. Leonard Maltin was just really brutal. And again, you know, you can't argue that there's some problems with this movie. Now, the stars in this film, and there's really basically four main stars I'm going to talk about tonight. Paul Langston, and these were all Americans. This was an all-American production, and you're going to kick up. Not only is it all-American, but it's going to have some familiar locations to monster movie fans. Paul Langston, he's one of those guys I knew right off the bat when I saw him. I've seen this guy somewhere before. Couldn't quite place it. And Paul was a guy, then I remembered he was, he did a few war films and a few westerns. I remember him for the film To Hell and Back with Audie Murphy. He played the colonel. He played Audie Murphy's colonel in that film. But he also went on to do a lot of television work and a lot of film work. I mean, he's a very prolific actor. He acted right up until the late 1970s and passed away in 1980. But he is probably going to be best known by a lot of people from the 60s for his regular character on the television show Peyton Place, which was sort of the first nighttime soap opera to hit the airwaves back in the early to mid-60s. I even watched it as a kid. Oh, we all did, because our parents were so much into it. Paul is just one of those guys that he's got a very unique voice and a very unique look, and he's a very competent actor. And I'll hand it to Wilder on this. He's got some people in here who are pretty good. I mean, it's not a lack of performance on the part of his actors. Some of it is a lack of the storyline is a little questionable. Our next actor is Leslie Dennison. He's the only British actor in the bunch, and he plays sort of an alcoholic type assistant to Paul Langston's character. Paul Langston plays this big botanist who is, you know, got this expedition that's been financed that takes them into the Himalayas, and they're studying plant life, especially, you know, flowers and specific plants and the effect that the higher altitudes of the Himalayas have on them. And Leslie Dennison is his doctor assistant. Plays a character by the name of Peter Wells. And every time we see Peter, it's a very stereotypical character. He's always taking a nip of scotch. He's got his little flask out and taking scotch, so we know. He also, we find out, has a full case of it that he is having hauled up the mountainside for as part of his supplies for the expedition. So yeah, a little bit of a stereotypical character, and not really, I'm not going to say he's not a bad guy, but he's not really a good guy either. He's sort of the kind of guy that's like, he's just sort of a pain in the butt to have along. And then our next guy who plays one of the Sherkas, who takes them up the mountains, and he's sort of the leader of the pack, and he plays a character by the name of Subra, played by Taru Shimada. And Taru will be a very, very familiar face to you for anyone who watched a lot of movies and television during the 1960s. Taru was the kind of guy that whenever a movie was made about World War II, especially in the Pacific Theater, he was like the token Japanese officer or soldier in that he was in the Battle of Coral Sea. He also played in some popular television shows like The $6 Million Man and others of that nature. And that's where a lot of us that grew up probably remember him from a lot of his television appearances. He was also in a James Bond film, You Only Live Twice. And he just always played that bad guy Asian in these films. And he sort of does that here. Now, the interesting thing about this film, the language that is spoken on the expedition when they actually go up into the mountains with the Sherkas, Subra is speaking to the other Sherkas that are helping them along the way up into the Himalayas. They're speaking a strange tongue. Well, it's Japanese because they're all Japanese actors. So, you know, it made them into Tibetan type actors. Now, the one other guy that I want to mention here is a guy who is sort of a favorite. He acted in this film under the name of Bill Phipps. Now, his actual name is William Phipps, and that is where you're going to see him in the credit lines for a lot of movies. Very prolific actor, very good actor. I will always remember William from War of the Worlds because he was one of the three guys that got vaporized in the beginning of War of the Worlds. You remember the three guys that were approaching the craft after the little head poked itself out of the crater, and they've got the white flag and they, you know, trying to make friends, and he gets vaporized with the other two guys. Also, we just talked about William Phipps not too long ago in our show about Catwoman of the Moon, because he was the guy that sort of fell for one of the Catwomen, and it was the good Catwoman, you know, the one that sort of helped them out. And he was the young guy, real young when he was in that film. In this film, he's playing a police detective, and we will get to that in just a few minutes. This film is split into two distinct separate parts. It's very similar to films like Lost World, Jurassic Park, or King Kong, film, you know, of that nature, where you start out in one location, an exotic location, and then you jump to the United States. And that's exactly how this film is laid out. And that's not a problem with this film. It works well. It's shot in sort of a film noir type style of early television, you know, late 40s, early 50s. I got to tell you, this film reminds me a lot of the first season of The Adventures of Superman. You hear me make a lot of reference to that, but it was one of the most popular television shows in the early 1950s. This is about the time that Superman was playing on television. It was a syndicated show on television. And you'll see a lot of similarities in the way this film was shot. So when we talk about the snow creature, as far as, you know, critique, and I'm really, as you know, on Monster Attack, I try not to be a critic of these films because I'd more like to express how these films impacted me or affected me as a kid when I watched them. You know, and I got to say, this was not one of my favorite films as a kid, mainly because it moved very slow. And the worst thing that a film can do is to be a little boring to a kid or to an adult. I mean, I gauge, you know, whether a film is good or bad on that more than I do on anything else. So you're going to see some similarities, the way this film is put together and shot and the way it's lit. You know, it's got a lot of shadows to it. The black and white actually really enhances this film. And I think it's a good thing they did it in black and white. It made it better than it probably really was. But you will also notice, you'll notice that a lot of the music that they use in here, they use a lot of stock music in this. And I think they almost overdo the music. Some of these low-budget films do too much with music, and it can become almost distracting. And it does in this film. And a lot of it is the kind of track music that they used in The Adventures of Superman. I looked it up and I was wondering if it was the same uh, same composer that did the music for Superman, and they were two different guys. So they were definitely using some studio, some studio tracks, stock type music that a lot of films did. Now, I was sort of laughing a little bit about where the filming locations, where this film was shot, is going to be familiar. Yeah, guess what? Our good friend, Bronson Caverns. Yeah, Bronson Caves, Bronson Canyon in Griffith Park. That's where they shot virtually all of this film. There's some shots that were done in a studio, but most of them were on location in Bronson Caves, and at least the Himalayan sections. Now, I gotta hand it to these guys, because for a low-budget film, I will give them kudos for their sets. They look really good. I mean, you almost feel cold when they get up into the mountain. Now, in the beginning of the trek, when they're down at the bottom of the mountain, it looks a little bit too warm for some of the clothing that they're wearing. You know, it's supposed to be Tibet, and it's supposed to be, a little cool or whatever, but, I mean, you're definitely in Los Angeles, California. I mean, I kept thinking, man, that just looks awfully warm for Tibet and the Himalayas. But once they got into the mountain and started working with the snow that they used and things like that, it looked pretty good. It actually, I'll give them kudos on that. I think that's one of the real pluses of that. And I will also give them kudos, again, on the way that they shot this in the film noir style. Now, unfortunately, it does not cover up some of the problems that they have in this film. Now, once again, what we've got is an expedition that's going up into the Himalayas. Dr. Frank Parrish, we'll call him Frank from here on out just to save some time. He's gotten permission from the Tibetans to put together this expedition and go up into the mountains. They've helped him find Surba, who is the leader. This is our guy played by Taru Shimada, and he has put together about 12 or 15 Sherpas to take him up into the mountains. And they can't use animals because of the mountain trails. They have to hike it up themselves. And up they go into the mountains looking for various plant life and things of that nature. And they're studying it at different altitudes. So they do plan on getting pretty far up into the mountains. Now, when they get about halfway up on their journey and set their first camp, they stake up their first camp, the scene shifts back to the city where they started at in Tibet. And we see this is where we first are introduced to the Yeti. And he's terrorizing this little city where they were from and kidnaps a woman. Now, we don't see him very well, but this is where some problems start developing with this film. Because, in all honesty, folks, I'm just going to come right out and say it. And I think anyone who's seen this film knows what I'm talking about. The costuming for this Yeti was awful. There's just no way around it. It was just pathetic. You don't see it too much in the beginning of this film because they keep the Yeti in the shadows, but all you basically see is his face and the rest of him sort of in a shadow. But even what you see, it's a problem. It looks like a guy wearing, one of those big hunting caps like they wore in Fargo. That sort of thing where it's down over the ears. One of those fuzzy caps that they wore, it looked bizarre. It just didn't look right. And they use the same shot. Wilder uses the same shot over and over again, where when the Yeti is stalking somebody, you see him step into the light. You just see him from the neck up. And then he steps back out of the light. They use that shot probably 15 times in this film. That's another thing that takes away from this film. So, the one thing, when you got a movie like this, that, the snow creature, and, they build it, about the abominable snowman. As a kid, you want to see the payoff. You hope that the monster suit looks good. And when it doesn't, that really colors your whole memory of the movie. And it did for me, even as a kid. And this is the thing that John Zachary and some of them really jumped on. It seems like they would have been better off. And I'm speculating here a little bit. Hey, who am I? I didn't make this movie. But it seems like you could have rented a gorilla costume and then, did some adaptation with the head to make it look a little more like what a Yeti might look like. Basically, the Yeti was a guy, they found a guy who was probably about 7 feet tall. And they put this stuff on him that, I swear, folks, it looks like pieces of shag carpet just sort of stitched together. No rhyme or reason. It's and at some point, they're trying to make, I'm trying to say this as delicately as I can, but they're trying to make a butt for the creature, you know, something that sort of looks like a an orangutan or a gorilla butt or that sort of thing. And oh boy, when you get to see that in the film, it's pretty bad. It's just like you just got to shake your head and go, yeah, this just didn't work at all. So I, you know, it would seem like to me, and again, this is just my opinion, I think they could have found a little extra money to invest in the suit. Now, the character of the Yeti is played by an actor. He's sort of a stuntman. His name is Locke Martin. He's 7'4", and that, you know, so I mean, he was perfect for the Yeti, but he's skinny. He's really, really skinny. Now, he is famous for playing one other character in a film that Madeline Brumby and I talked about, a very good science fiction film called Day the Earth Stood Still. He played Gort. You know, he was dressed up in the big, you know, uniform. So, you know, Locke got a lot of work because he was such a tall guy. I mean, 7'4", yeah, I'm surprised he didn't play in the NBA. But that is going to be a problem with this film. So they're up in the mountains, and word comes up to, gets up to Subra that his wife, it's his wife that's been kidnapped by the Yeti. Now he is on a mission. He has to find the Yeti. And he tells Frank and Peter, he says, you know, we've got to find the Yeti. We've just got to stop and we've got to do this. And he explains to him. And then you get a little bit of a background of the Yeti and the legend, because for a lot of people in 1954, watching this film, they didn't, you know, there wasn't that much known about the Abominable Snowman. You know, it was just, you didn't hear that much about it. A little legend going around. Not like today when, you know, there were, you know, all kinds of books and TV shows and movies, internet, you know, all kinds of things. But this was still relatively a little known legend at the time. Well, Subra, basically, he takes all of the weapons and removes all of their cartridges. And he gets him into a position where he basically blackmails him into going with him up a different part of the mountain to go find the Yeti. And they get attacked a few times. The Yeti makes it into their camp and attacks a couple of the Sherkas, and to the point where a lot of the Sherkas just end up taking off. They will not go any farther. So you've got Frank and Peter, and you know they're the only ones left, and they're trying to figure a way that they can get a radio signal back, because Subra has damaged the radio, so they can't radio the home base, and they're not able to do that. So they finally have to just go along with this. And to make a long story short, Subra is able to track a creature. We don't know if it's the creature that took his wife or not, but it leads us into a cave. And, you know, first time I saw this movie as a kid, I thought, yeah, that's Bronson Canyon. That's Bronson Caves. Because it looks so similar to all of the caves you would see in monster movies back then. That this is one of the darker areas of this film. They find a Yeti, but they also find a female Yeti and a child. They're all there in this cave. And of course, he sees them and you know, immediately takes up defense, and he pulls a, you know, a big rock out of this cave and causes a cave-in, which kills the wife and the child. But he survives, and they're able to. Now, this is a part where the story suffers a little bit. This is a part where Wells says, "Hey, I've got a hypodermic that will knock him out." And you know, so he and Parrish have these inoculations. I mean, you know, I kept thinking, this is a botanist. What's he doing with this kind of stuff? That's never explained. And they are able to tranquilize the Yeti and bring him back down to the town where they started out. They get permission from the Tibetans to keep the Yeti there. They've got them, you know, they have a, what I will say is a refrigerated unit manufactured so they can take him back to the United States. Because now Wells is thinking, you know, Peter, he's thinking, we're going to make $1 million off this thing. I mean, we're going to make a fortune off of this thing. And this is where there's a little bit of a similarity with King Kong, because you got sort of the same thing. You know, they end up taking this Yeti back to the United States. Now, again, it comes back to Los Angeles, and now, this is one of the more interesting parts of the story, because generally this was the kind of thing we didn't always see in a lot of monster movies. It's touched on a little bit in War of the Colossal Beasts, and it's sort of like, okay, you're bringing, like, is this an animal? Is this a human? What is it? And so it's the Yeti is left in limbo in this refrigerated unit. It's like a portable closet, a refrigerator type thing. You can sort of see him through the window, but you really, again, you don't really see what the suit looks like. It's going to be during these scenes now when they're back in the United States where you're really going to see what the Yeti suit looks like. And this is the real downer to this movie. I mean, you've already been somewhat disappointed at the few little snippets of the Yeti that you've seen in the mountains, but this is pretty bad. While they're trying to decide whether this is an animal or whether this is human, because it all depends on what kind of visa they need to keep them in the United States, you know, all of the red tape that goes along with customs and that sort of thing, you know, and they just simply want the creature taken to their, you know, to a laboratory to be studied. You know, they want to keep it alive. Well, he gets away. And this is where we really see the Yeti for the first time. And folks, this is the part that's a killer. I mean, you know, and again, it's no knock on the guy playing the Yeti, Locke Martin. It's not his fault. He's really skinny. And that sort of enhances how badly this Yeti costume is, because it's just little hunks of fur sort of stuck on him. The head looks bad. This fake butt looks just ridiculous. And, he clobbers the guard that's there, and that's sort of an awkward fight scene, so to speak. And he escapes into Los Angeles. This is when we get introduced to William Phipps's character, Lieutenant Dunbar. He is going to be the main police guy that tries to track this Yeti down. Now, the big problem they have is that they have these sightings. He attacks people. He's killing people in Los Angeles, and they're trying to track down a pattern on their map, and they've sort of triangulated where he's going to be, and then all of a sudden he shows up like 10 miles away, and then he shows up 30 miles away, and they can't figure out how in the world is he doing this? How is he, the line is, how is he walking the streets and somebody's not seeing him? Because, he just pops up out of nowhere and will attack somebody and then disappear as fast as he popped up. And they finally figure it out when they think about the storm drains that run beneath Los Angeles. Now, this might bring up a memory of another film that was released this same year in 1954 that dealt with giant ants. And where did they hide in Los Angeles? In the storm drains. So they use a similar, and again, this is a good plot line, because I forgot, they said there, I forgot how many thousands of miles of storm drains there are beneath Los Angeles. I mean, it's massive. So they've got to track this thing down in the storm drains. Now, this is a low budget film, so they can't bring in the United States Army, but they finally alert the public to what is going on. You know, there's this creature on the loose that's very deadly. Stay in your homes. Don't go out on the streets. And they basically just have a small police force trying to track him down. That's where the low budget sort of kills this thing. Now, remember in them, they had the army, and they had the National Guard, and they had the reserves, and everybody flooding into these storm drains to find the ants. Well, they don't have this to find Yeti, and he's prowling around in these storm drains. So they start where he was last seen and try to work themselves back and see if they can get him that way. And they do. They do find him. They find him in one of the storm drains, and they set up a trap with a big net, and they sort of, you've got Dunbar, who, by the way, as a little side story, before he goes to get on this search for the Yeti, he finds out that his wife is about ready to have a baby any time, and they're just waiting for that to happen, but he's got to go track down the Yeti. So it's he and Frank are going after the Yeti. Now, we don't see Wells, Peter Wells, anymore, because he sort of gave this thing away. He sort of let the press know that the Abominable Snowman was heading to the United States, and that created a whole mess with the media and stuff. So when I said He's not a really a good guy. He's not really a bad type guy, but he's not a nice guy. You know, his mind is strictly on how much money he's going to make and probably how much scotch, you know, he can buy with the money. So he's, again, he's the kind of guy, man, you just can't put any trust in him. And, you know, he's just a bad guy to have around. So you basically got Dunbar and Frank, you know, on this trek, and they do find they track the Yeti down. They do corner him, and they get him into this net, and they're fighting with one another. Got this big fight going on with the Yeti and the guys. And Frank, all of a sudden, the Yeti grabs him by the throat and starts choking him and starts strangling him. And Phipps's character Dunbar has no other option but just to empty his pistol into the Yeti and kill him. You know, they were trying to keep him alive as much as they could so they could study him, but now they're going to have to study a dead Yeti. And, you know, everything ends up happily ever after. Dunbar finds out that there's a creature waiting for him, but it's a little baby creature that his son was just born. And it ends on a fun note. You know, there's some attempts to lighten things up a little bit on this, but folks, the biggest problem with Snow Creature is that costume. There's things that I could forgive in this film that, you know, where I could say it's really not that bad of a movie. It does move a little slowly. You got a lot of cave exploring scenes and mountain climbing scenes that seem, at a point, they're almost filler. You know, that's a real fine line that you walk in a movie when you're making a movie about this sort of thing, that you can overdo it. You know, you want to suggest the climbing without showing a play-by-play account of them going up the Himalayas, but that drags on a little bit. And then the quest under the streets of Los Angeles, that goes on a little bit too. You know, so that you're damned if you do, damned if you don't, because if you find him too quick, people are going to say, well, that few people, how could you find him so quickly? And if you show it too much, it gets boring and you lose your audience. So these are some of the problems with the Snow Creature, but the biggest is the suit. It's the suit. You know, they should have done something, I think, to pad our creature up a little bit. The 7'4" works great, but he's so skinny. You know? Oh my God. I mean, Lockhart is so skinny. As you know, I've only known a couple of 7'4" guys, and that was back in my days in the Carolinas in college. There were a couple of guys who played basketball that were, one was 7'2" and one was 7'4". And then, you know, skinny as a rail. They needed somehow to buff this guy up. And then they needed a suit that was, you know, solid hair or fur. It was the patch quilt type approach to his costume that just doesn't work. And the butt thing just was really ludicrous. And the way they made his head look. Like I said, it looks like, you know, someone from Second City TV. Who are the two guys from Canada, you know, that always drank beer? Can't think of their name, you know, Dave Thomas and the other guy there. You know, it looked like that. So I'm going to say on Snow Creature, I'm going to leave it to you on this one, folks. If you have not seen this movie, you may have heard about it, or you may have seen some clips from it. Like I said, it's got some problems, but it's one of those, I'm a fan of bad films. So I forgive a lot more than some people would, just out of curiosity's sake, if you want to see what all of the talk was about, because this film does get talked about a lot. That's for sure. It's not as good as an Ed Wood film. Okay. I'm going to leave it at that. And we're going to be talking about some Ed Wood films this season as well, because we definitely need to bring them into this time period as well. But it's, like I said, it's sort of the level of a made-for-TV film from the mid-1950s. That's why, or a syndicated-type film that would be shown on TV in the 1950s. It reminded me a lot of The Adventures of Superman, but that's not to say The Adventures of Superman was bad like this. I loved The Adventures of Superman, but I just, in that style. It's that similar film noir type style. A little bit too much narration in this as well. I didn't mention that in the beginning of our timeline, but a lot of narration in this, which I think a lot of times as a kid signaled to me that the film had some problems. I guess so they had to do a lot of narration. If you notice, you know, a lot of Ed Wood movies, he does a lot of narration as well. Probably some sound issues. But anyway, The Snow Creature, 1954. Check it out if you're interested. But, you know, it's one of those, believe it or not, folks, it's available on DVD and Blu-ray. Now, the DVD copies I saw ran anywhere from about $8 to $11. I'm not sure how much the Blu-ray sells for. But in all honesty, folks, I would try to find this somewhere on a streaming service or somewhere where you wouldn't have to pay for it, because I think you're going to be disappointed if you spend money on it, unless you just want to buy a movie like this. So I'll leave it at that. I'll leave it to your discretion with The Snow Creature. Hey, folks, we'll be back with you again next Monday with another episode of Monster Attack. And I do want to remind you, if you visit our website up at projectentertainmentnetwork.com, check on the store tab and check out all the cool stuff we have for sale up there. Got a lot of stuff for Monster Attack fans up there. And we're having a big sale on t-shirts this month for the next few days. So, you know, it's going to end fairly soon here. So check it out. You can get up to 30% off on Monster Attack t-shirts. Yeah, wouldn't that be great to wear around? And check out all of the stuff we have for all of our other shows. We've got 25 podcasts now on Project Entertainment Network. So check them out, projectentertainmentnetwork.com. And folks, we'll see you next Monday. Have a great week. Thanks for listening.
Necrocasticon, the podcast that blends horror and heavy metal properties with a common connection, brought to you by hosts Token Tom Glock, Max Axe, Smoking Wart Hades, and Azrael Mordecai. Featuring interviews and more with the stars of metal and horror. The Necrocasticon, Mondays on Project Entertainment Network.
This has been an exclusive presentation of the Project Entertainment Network.